Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show planned for you today. My guest will be Barbara Katz-Rothman. She's a professor of sociology, public health, and women's studies at the City University of New York. And she's come out with a new book, and I'll tell you more about it in just a little bit. First, I want to just go over some things going on in the news and some events going on in our area that you might be interested in, and, of course, share with you a recipe. So, you know, it's an interesting time we're living in, as we all know. The DARK Act was defeated temporarily. Of course, it's going back to the drawing board, so our work is not over. But in light of defeating the DARK Act, which would have made it illegal for states to have their own individual mandatory labeling laws. You know, we're looking forward to Vermont's law going into effect in July. And General Mills has just come out and announced that they are going to start labeling all of their products GMO-free. Now, General Mills also owns Progresso and Haagen-Dazs, Betty Crocker, and many other products in our stores. As we all know, so many of the products in the stores are owned by the majority of like 10 different big food conglomerates. So getting one to say they're going to label is a big deal. And one of the things that makes it such a big deal is not so much that all of a sudden they're going to start labeling, but because they don't really want to have to put a label that says their product has genetically modified ingredients in it, because, of course, people will look at that product as inferior. They are trying to reformulate a lot of their products to be GMO-free, which is what they've done in Europe. In Europe, there is mandatory labeling, and as a result, most of the big food conglomerates, Nestle, General Foods, you know, most of them make their products GMO-free because they know the people in the European Union do not want to buy those products. So by doing that, it then has a rippling effect, because right now we don't even have enough raw product to make all these products GMO-free. So it's going to push the farmers and the growers to start producing corn without GMOs and soy without GMOs and sugar beets without GMOs, so that they can be used by these manufacturers. So the ripple effect is really powerful. So this is big news and really exciting. Also, I posted an article on how important it is for diversity in our products. Wild species are really important in the foods we grow, and right now the usual produce that we find in the store is, you know, very mainstream. You have your plum tomatoes, your cherry tomatoes, your heirloom, not your heirloom, but your beefsteak. I mean, there's not the variety, but if you go to a farmer's market, you could see 200 varieties of tomatoes. We need to really bring back these different varieties so that we are ready if there is a drought or, you know, a certain pest, that these more wild varieties are more resistant naturally to these different environmental conditions. So bringing back wild species and having choice is really, really important. I also want to just encourage all of you to take some action. There's some petitions on my website. One is to stand up for offshore wind power on Long Island. That is really important that we start investing in alternative energies. We've seen the destruction that the fracking has had on our environment. We see the destruction of coal all the time. The offshore drilling that they're doing for oil is really, you know, wreaking havoc on our oceans. So we really need to invest in something that is renewable, especially to meet our goals that were discussed at the Paris talks. So offshore wind is one way of doing that. So please support that and sign the petition. And I want to share with you some great events that are going on in and around the city. This evening, actually, this is out in Bridgehampton, but there is, sponsored by Slow Food East End, a spring market dinner at the restaurant Almond. And they still have some tickets, so that's a fun event. You can go to Slow Food East End to buy a ticket. Next Thursday is a great event going on at St. John the Divine. Actually, all week long, there's the end of an exhibit that has been going on called The Value of Food, Sustaining a Green Planet. And that's been on view for a month now, but it's about food security, accessibility, and sustainability. And it's an art show. And next Thursday, there's an event called Evening of Witness, which is a night of discussion and music being curated by Anna Lappe from the Small Planet Institute. It's free, but they do require you to RSVP. So I have a link to that on my website, or you can go to the Small Planet Institute and sign up for that. March 31st also, there is a documentary screening out here on Long Island from Sustainable Institute of Molloy College. It's a screening of the documentary The True Cost, and that's talking about the story of our clothing, the people who make them, the people who wear them, and the impact the industry is having on our world. It includes a vegan buffet, as well as a discussion following the film. There's a suggested donation of $5. I've gone to many of those events, and they're really a wonderful community event. April 2nd, spring soiree and auction to support the Hawthorne Valley Waldorf School and also the Hawthorne Valley Place-Based Learning Center. That's taking place up in Hudson, at the Hudson Lodge. April 4th, there's an event called Taste That Jazz out at Eisenhower Park. It's, you know, featuring the foods of New Orleans and great jazz music. Cocktails are included, and that is also a fundraiser for the Safe Center Long Island, which is a center that provides services to children and adults victims of abuse. So that's a wonderful thing to support. Adelphi University is sponsoring their first TEDx event on April 5th, and they have a lineup of 9 different speakers, all answering the theme, What If? And it should be a great event. I've gone to many TEDx Manhattan events, and they were always wonderful. They are holding a lottery for the tickets, so you can go onto the Adelphi University website to find out about that. I also have a link from my website. April 8th and 9th, Food and Enterprise Summit is happening in New York City, and that's a coming together of entrepreneurs and investors who want to improve our local food system. April 10th through 12th, Chefs Collaborative Summit. Chefs Collaborative is an organization I'm a member of. It's a group of chefs who care about sustainability and raising awareness by having healthier foods being represented on their menus, where the food's coming from, who's producing it, that kind of thing. Great organization, and this is a 3-day summit in New York City. April 11th, SunWorks is having their 8th annual Greenhouse Project benefit. This is a great organization that brings science and sustainability education into New York City public schools. It's at the top of the standard from 6 to 9 on April 11th. What else? April 16th, the Peconic Land Trust, which is a great organization that has helped keep a lot of open land from being developed out on the east end of Long Island. They're looking for volunteers from 10 to 12 all day on April 16th. They're going to be having people work on different projects. So get in touch with them if you're out that way or you want to work with a bunch of people helping clean up the water and the beaches and land out there. April 18th, Wellness in the Schools is having their gala. Spring is full of these galas. It's a great time if you want to go to some of these events and network and meet people who are all trying to better food in not only the workplace, the school place, but just in general. Wellness in the Schools was started by Bill Telepan, and they do great work to bring food education into the public schools of New York City. April 20th through 21st is a Food Tank Summit. This is taking place down in Washington, D.C. As a matter of fact, I will be recording my show that Thursday live down from the Food Tank Summit in Washington. So that will be a great show, but it's a great event if you are really a foodie and interested in where your food comes from and the issues around food. It's a great event. April 30th, the 12th Annual Sheep Shearing Festival is going on up at Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture. And May 7th and 8th is the New York Vegetarian Food Festival. And I could keep going on and on, but I'm not going to because it just takes too much time. But go to my website at IE Green to see a lineup of all these great events. I'd like to share a recipe with you now. This past Sunday, I helped sponsor a great event that took place at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. It was sponsored by the Cinema Arts Center and Slow Food North Shore, which is the slow food chapter that I chair out here on Long Island. And this event was just great. It's the third annual Long Island Food and Film Feast. And what we do is we showed 8 short documentaries. All were paired with food that was highlighted in the film, as well as a speaker that could talk about the issues that was brought up in the film. And it was just a great event. And one of the things that we did was we showed a short documentary on the oyster divers of Long Island Sound. And these are guys that really go out there and handpick oysters. But of course, we also support people that have different dietary needs, and so we wanted to have an alternative to the fried oysters. So this recipe was our alternative to the po' boy oysters, and this is po' boy tofu with a Cajun cashew remoulade sauce. So instead of the oysters, we did the tofu, and the cream sauce is made with a cashew cream. So I first marinated the tofu. So I cut the firm tofu into cubes, but first I pressed it between some paper towels to remove some of the water, and I made a marinade. And for the marinade, it was 1 cup of coconut milk, 1 teaspoon of Old Bay spice, 1.5 tablespoons of a Cajun like emerald essence spice, 1/2 teaspoon salt, and 1 teaspoon of another Cajun spice. But basically, you just want to, you know, put a lot of those Cajun spices, and you can look up emerald essence recipe online and get that and mix that up yourself. Very easy. And I bought a Cajun mixed spice at Whole Foods, and I used that. And I just marinated the tofu overnight. You could marinate it just up to an hour, but I let it sit overnight. I figured it would be that much better, and it really was good. For the breading, I used 1/2 cup of masa harina, which is a cornmeal that has some lime in it, rind in it, and it's really very flavorful. 1/4 cup of gluten-free flour, 1/4 cup of gluten-free breadcrumbs, 1.5 tablespoons emerald essence again, 1 teaspoon Old Bay spice, and 1 teaspoon of lemon zest. And that was the breading. And then for the remoulade sauce, I used 1 pound of cashews that I soaked for 3 hours and then drained, 2 cups of water, juice of 2 lemons, 1 teaspoon Cajun spice, 3 tablespoons horseradish, 1 teaspoon salt, 2 teaspoons of a jalapeno hot sauce, and 1/4 cup of ketchup. This is more sauce than we needed, so you could really cut this in half, unless you want to have leftover sauce. I still have some in the refrigerator. It will last a long time, but still, you might not want to make so much. Anyway, so you're going to marinate the tofu overnight in the coconut milk marinade. The next day or an hour later, you're going to take the tofu cubes out, and you're going to dredge them into the breading. And then in a heavy cast iron skillet, you're going to fry up the tofu cubes. Now, I used a safflower oil, a non-GMO safflower oil. You can use a non-GMO canola oil would be fine as well. You could even fry it up in some coconut oil, and that would be really good as well. And then in a blender, I mixed all of the cashew ingredients together, and I garnished it with some chopped parsley, or you could also garnish it with some cilantro. That would be great. And that is the recipe. So, of course, I love hearing feedback on the recipes. So if you do make it, please send me a note and let me know how you liked it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Dr. Barbara Katz-Rothman. She is a PhD professor of sociology, public health, disability studies, and women's studies at the City University of New York, where she also runs the food studies concentration. She's an author of many books, and we're here to talk about her newest book called A Bun in the Oven, How the Food and Birth Movements Resist Industrialization. And it's a really great book. I mean, it's just amazing to bring together these two movements that people think of separately. You know, I've been involved in the birth movement as well, just because my sister was a midwife, and I have many midwifery friends, so I've been very passionately involved with that. And the food movement, you all know I'm passionately involved in, and here is Dr. Barbara Katz-Rothman, who has brought the two together. Barbara, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Sure. So maybe you can first share with us a little bit of your history as to how you got involved in the birth movement first, and then we'll move on to how you brought it into the food movement.
Well, a very, very, very long time ago, I was pregnant with my first kid, and I just felt I did not want to give birth in a hospital. It seems to me hospitals, my experience with them is where people went when they were really, really sick and they died, and it just wasn't a happy place to be. And we didn't have a home birth movement. This was the 1970s in New York. We didn't have the phrase home birth. So after maybe, I'm not kidding, maybe 50, 60 obstetrician offices hung up on me telling me I was trying to kill my baby or something, I found a feminist obstetrician who had worked with the Jane movement, which did the illegal abortions in Chicago. Mm. And she understood the concept of a woman's right to choose. And she also thought I was kind of crazy, but if I wanted to have the baby at home, she was willing to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So she attended the birth. And you ever have one of those experiences where two parts of your brain are operating at the same time? So one part of me was, like, giving birth is a big project, so I was totally overwhelmed. The other part of me was going, oh, that is so weird. Oh, that is so weird. Because I was watching this woman, just a fish out of water. When I finally pushed this baby out, I ended up, she wanted me to be on my bed, and we put board boxes under my bed so it would be up high, not to hurt her back, you know, look like a delivery table. But I'd been laboring in a chair, and I was perfectly comfortable in the rocking chair I was in, so I ended up giving birth in that chair. And as I push this baby out and I lean forward to take him from my body, she takes him out and puts him behind her, and as if a nurse was going to materialize in the room. So, you know, my mother got to hold him first, all fine. She then, at the time I didn't even know how insane this was, just reached in and scooped out the placenta, which is insane, okay? That is, like, dangerous and stupid. But it was standard medical practice because there was somebody else waiting for the delivery room. Huh. And you had to get the woman out quickly, and that's how she practiced. Of course, there wasn't anybody else waiting to give birth in my bedroom that day, so it wasn't really necessary. And the risks of hemorrhage with removing a placenta by hand too quickly are insane, and the physical pain and intrusion, I mean, it was wrong. But obviously it took me a while to think through, like a matter of weeks or months, to think through just how crazy that whole scene had been. And I started to, I was a sociology doctoral student. I was very intrigued by the sociology of knowledge. How do you know what you know? And that part of my head got going. And I'd been looking at it beforehand because people kept saying, oh, hospitals are so safe. And I'm like, okay, what do you need at this hospital for a birth? Because they never just whip out a knife and do a cesarean section of a moment. You transfer the woman to an operating room, and the average time of transfer was an hour, 2 hours. And I lived 15 minutes from a hospital, so what was it? And it would be like, you know, an injection of Pitocin. Okay, we bring a needle, you know. So the whole knowledge, how do you know what you know, was fascinating to me. And I ended up doing my dissertation, basically sociology of knowledge, about how people know what they know about birth and how so much of our knowledge is influenced by the fairly insane birth system that hospitals had developed.
Mm-hmm. It's true, and I think we really have really bad outcomes as well with high-end birth system that we promote.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at this point, more than a third of all births are done surgically, which, you know, when you think about it, makes sense. Obstetrics is a surgical specialty. So, you know, to a man with a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And to a surgeon, every problem looks like it needs surgery. So,
right.
Of course, they do surgery. Our maternal mortality rates rose with our rising cesarean section rates. You're not going to do major abdominal surgery on that many people and not kill some of them. Our infant mortality statistics don't look good. I mean, no, this has not been good for women or babies, but we have a very, very highly medicalized approach.
Mm-hmm. And so then how did you come to merge this birth movement that you've been passionately involved with for so many years? How did you see the connection to the food movement? How did you find your way into that?
Okay, so this is a kind of a fun story, and how nice it is to just have colleagues. I worked on the birth movement and things related to it and looked at the development of reproductive technologies and genetic testing and all kinds of things related to pregnancy and birth. And some of them were more interesting and some of them were just plain depressing. I worked on the Human Genome Project issues for years, and it was, you know, it's hard, it's sad, it's depressing. And maybe 20 years ago, I just had one of those cranky moments one has in life where I can't do this anymore. And I thought, I don't remember, some conversation I had with somebody, I thought, oh, it'd be fun to look at how older women talk about food from their childhood. So listening to my 90-something-year-old aunt and an 80-something-year-old neighbor, I just got interested. And the university has this program of like $2,000 summer money grants, and I applied for one, started this research project. We did not, it was so long ago, we didn't have expressions that now, you know, food memory, food voice, that wasn't there. So I just wrote this little proposal about how older women remember food, and I called it I Remember Pot Roast, and I was just going to talk to people. And I did maybe 6-8 interviews. I transcribed them. I never published a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So move forward, and you have a food movement, and a colleague, Professor John Deutsch, who at that point was at CUNY, City University in New York, and is now at Drexel University in Philly. But John was at CUNY, and he was trying to get something started in food studies at CUNY, because he's a food studies scholar of some renown. And he just did a really intelligent search and found this unpublished little in-house grant and said to me, want to come and participate in our food studies program? And I was, John, I don't know anything about this. He said, no, please come. And you know the politics of a university, if all the people interested in something are very junior, it's tricky. So there I was, gray-haired senior professor. I realized, okay, I'll be handy. Sure, John, I'll come.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to some food studies meetings. I listened to some stuff. It really was interesting. And then I had one of those mega aha moments. I had thought maybe there is some connection between home birth and home cooking, trying to do things outside of the industrial model. So I had been casually but thoughtfully exploring the relationships between home birth and home cooking. But man, they just really, it's not the same thing. You give birth maybe one, twice, three, rarely, you find somebody who has four births, whereas dinner is like over and over.
Right.
Not to mention breakfast and lunch and late snacks. So home cooking is kind of constant, and home birth is a production, and a rarity. So, whatever. It was interesting, but I didn't think I was going anywhere. And then I went to a food studies conference. It was actually in Montreal, So it was half in French, half in English. I flunked French. I don't speak French, whatever. And at this conference, and there was a panel of people doing artisanal food making. So there was a butcher. There was a baker, no candlestick maker, but you had a butcher, a baker, a cheesemaker. Maybe I'll remember who else. And they were talking about their craft. Oh, and a beer guy. And they were talking about what they were doing. And the baker guy had found some wheat in the back of a barn in Nowhere, Ohio, in the middle of nothing, that was from like 1800, that was a kind of wheat that was no longer produced. And he had taken it to somewhere where they had cloned the wheat, grown new wheat of a type of wheat that had become extinct, grown the wheat, ground it, made bread. There was the brewer, there, you know, all of these people were talking. And they were trying to come together on what it was that they, as artisanal food makers, were doing that was different than, you know, you were just talking about General Mills and Kraft and Nestle and, you know, six companies that own the food of the world. Mm-hmm. And they were just talking about what they did that was so different. And I think it was the butcher was like, well, you know, we're not high tech, we're blah, blah, blah. And the guy who was making cheese started to laugh and said, do you have any idea what is happening in cheese science these days? And the wheat guy said, excuse me, cloned? Hello? Yeah, okay, so yeah, we do use high tech. And then, but we're not major, big, we don't have 40 people working for us. And the brewer was, you know, when you count the bottlers and da-da-da-da, I think maybe I do have a payroll of over 40. And I listened to them try to come to what it is about artisanal food work that is different than industrial food work. And pretty much everything that came up was, well, sometimes I do have to do that, or sometimes I am that. And what they seemed to finally be settling on was that they value the process, that there is something about process that is important, and it's not only product. And at that point, I actually started to laugh, totally inappropriately, tried to cover it up, because I realized they sounded like conversations I've been listening to among midwives for the past 30 years, where somebody says, well, you know, it's not like we're using complicated science. And one midwife says, excuse me, I'm working in an HIV clinic. Do you have any idea what the science is now around HIV transmission? Mm-hmm. And another one is like, well, you know, it's not like we're working with strangers. I have meaningful relationships with women in my practice. Another one says, you know what? I work in a hospital. The elevated door opens. There's a 16-year-old kid in labor crying that I've never seen before. Don't you tell me I'm not her midwife. Mm-hmm. And it was like at every point, where this is what we don't do that the industry does, they were saying, yeah, well, sometimes. And when I finally realized, okay, I found the difference between the midwives and the artisanal food makers, nobody cried and nobody hugged. Other than that, these were two groups of people who were doing the same thing. They were trying to pull an important, precious piece of life back from industrialization and thus launched the book.
Wow. Great. Well, it's really wonderful. I mean, for me especially, I'm sure there's other people that are like me, but, you know, because I also, you know, appreciated both of those worlds and both of those movements. And I see the correlation very, very closely, you know, and I also see it amongst, you know, and you touched on this in the book, too, that there's a big discrepancy between the haves and the have-nots, and the socioeconomic position that one has in life also affects their outcome and their access to these alternatives. You know, it's more expensive very often to have a home birth than a hospital birth. If you're covered by Medicaid, you know, Medicaid will pay for a hospital birth. They won't touch a home birth. You know, the care that you can get, the healthy food, you know, going to a farmer's market. I mean, there's programs now that will double up your bucks or give you, you know, two for one if you shop at a farmer's market, if you're on, supplemental income stamps. But it's really, you know, the access is much harder, you know, to find good food in a food desert, quote, end quote, neighborhood than it is, you know, in Midtown. So maybe you could talk a little bit how you saw the those two.
Well, this is something that I heard from both the artisanal food makers and the midwives. There is a concern, sometimes an accusation, I don't know, that it's elitist, okay, that you're just doing elitist things and the important stuff. People who are worried about getting enough food to eat don't care about whether it's GMO or not. People who just need access to services, which we call care when medicine, but it's not, it's services, don't care about the human loving touch, blah, blah, blah. It's elitist to be worrying about those things. But the truth is that if you are fabulously wealthy and in good shape and everything else, the disaster that much of our food has become through industrialization is probably not going to kill you. If you're poor and scraping by, yeah, I mean, look at which children are getting diabetes. It's not the
and
most
they're dealing
part
with
the wealthy.
Obesity epidemic.
Yeah, it's not for the most part the wealthy that are suffering the harms of our food system. It's the poor. So if you care about changing the food system, the people who are going to be affected are going to be the poor more than the wealthy. The same with the maternal and child health outcome stuff. That if somebody's been nurtured and healthy for two generations back, there's been enough food, there's been clean air, they're basically coming out of wealth and entitlement in the U.S. Yeah, you can mess around with them pretty badly in their pregnancy and birth, and probably the baby will be okay anyway. If you come out of two generations of lead-poisoned air, bad food, you're more vulnerable in your pregnancy. It's got generational effects. So while you can call it elitist to provide better food and better care in birth, actually, the people who are at the bottom of our hierarchy are the ones who are at greater risk from our bad food and birth systems. So you end up with something that I just found interesting to be thinking about, that we know money does not trickle down, okay? Got it? We have a very, very wealthy, wealthy, wealthy top, and the money is staying right up there. Thank you. And they don't even tip bigger. Okay, money is not trickling down. But something that I don't have a good word for, style, fashion, whatever, that does trickle down. So think about this in the food world. The invention of white bread, whatever that was, you'll know better than me. I wrote about it and looked it up, but don't remember. Mm-hmm. Give or take 100 years ago, refining the flour, creating this white bread, that was a fashion statement. The wealthy people could afford it. And so they didn't eat the whole grain bread. They ate this elite white bread. Look forward some years, and I grew up on silver cup, white sliced crap bread. That's what was available. My mother, who didn't have a lot of money, that's what we ate. We also sometimes went to the Jewish bakery and had wonderful Jewish bread. But standard bread, the bread that was at school, the bread that was available cheapest, was white bread. Rich elite people gave up on white bread. They went to the whole grain, fancy seven grain, blah, blah, blah breads. And look around now. It's starting to look really suspicious if in a poor neighborhood you serve sliced white bread for breakfast to the kids. It looks really weird when they're unloading processed white flour off the care trucks in the back of the Beyond where people are starving. It's important now to bring back the whole grain. That is all about the fluctuating tastes and values of the elite. And in the birth world, just think about this. If every woman in the United States who earned over, whatever, $150,000 a year family income had an elective cesarean section, that was the plan. If she earned over $150,000 a year, you just scheduled your cesarean at your and your doctor's convenience. How would a woman feel having her absolutely magnificent, beautiful, loving home birth, all of that, with a midwife in her home, if every wealthy woman had the elective section, how would you feel at your beautiful home birth? On the other hand, if every woman who earned over $150,000 a year called a midwife as soon as she thought she was in labor, and a midwife and her assistant arrived at the woman's home, evaluated whether or not she was in labor, stayed or not, as the woman chose, starting then or whenever, and that birth was attended by the midwife and her assistant in her home, and the midwife and the assistant stayed until the baby was 12, 13 hours old. They provided everything the woman needed and left. How would everybody else feel on their way to their hospital in labor?
Mm-hmm.
What you do at the top absolutely matters for the experience at the economic bottom.
Right. Very interesting. But it would be interesting to see how can we get all those women to want the home birth to start with.
Well, I think one of the ways we are doing it is by providing it at the top. I mean, if you'll notice, every time some elite woman, an actress, a singer, wife of a governor, whatever, every time one of those women has a home birth, other women start looking at it and go, oh, wait, there's a thought. So I've been saying to midwives for a long time, I know you want to be where the women are, and I don't blame you, and you want to go where the women who really, really desperately need you are. But take turns going to the wealthy neighborhoods, setting up beautiful little birth clinics, and working with the women who are likely to become the next governor or the next first lady or whatever. And you work with those women because we need to reach the top just as we need to reach the bottom economically.
Mhm. Yeah, look at what the garden on the White House lawn did for school food and raising the awareness of
exactly
eating vegetables
exactly
to the poor. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean you need it at both places. You need and it's sad, but this is how stuff like this works. You need a certain amount of privilege to make the choice respectable.
Right. Right. On that note, Barbara, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to go a little bit more into your book and the comparisons that you make between the two movements, okay?
Super.
Everyone, don't go anywhere. We're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Dr. Barbara Katz-Rothman. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm here with Dr. Barbara Katz-Rothman talking about her new book, A Bun in the Oven, How the Food and Birth Movements Resist Industrialization. Barbara?
Hi.
Hi. So going back to your book, I want to talk about some of the key similarities and differences that you talk about and bring up between these two very important social movements. Going into profit, transparency, authenticity. Maybe you could touch on some of those for us.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really struck me were the historical patterns. If you start right now and you say resist industrialization, you kind of forget how industrialization happened. And for me, I mean, I know the birth world, and I've just been in it, and there's so much you take for granted when you've been working in an area for so long. So, you know, the short story of the birth world is once upon a time, people had their babies with midwives, docs took over, they ran a very ugly, racist, horrible campaign in cities to get rid of midwives. They wanted all births in the hospital under their care. About controlling medical services generally. They just kind of were wiping out all kinds of alternative services that anything related to the body docs were in charge of.
Around when did that happen?
Well, it varied across the U.S. in poorer and wealthier places, but roughly 1900, 1920, 1930. Mm-hmm. There was still some mopping up going on in 1950, but from the early industrialization eras, late 1800s, through till pre-World War I, they got it locked. So pretty much all the births were in the hospital. what happened then, post-World War II, baby boomers, there was a bit of an objection by middle-class women, particularly, to this very ugly scene where you would come in, they'd give you this horrible medication that did not address pain at all, but addressed the memory of pain. So women were in horrible pain, but they didn't necessarily remember what happened during that time afterwards. But they had to be strapped down, which of course increases the pain. And medical textbooks showed you pictures of women who had hurt themselves falling out of bed and biting themselves and stuff. And they were left unattended, just sitting in a room with six other, well, lying flat, strapped in a room with six other women in this condition, were then wheeled into an operating room. The baby was extracted. They were sent off to a recovery room. The baby was sent to a newborn kid. And then,
horrible.
A day or two later, they introduced the mother to the baby. So that's pretty bad. That was standard care. It was pretty bad. And you started to have people objecting. And so the early level of objecting was, I don't want to be separated from anybody I ever knew when I go into labor. So you started to have this notion of, couldn't the husband stay with a woman? And it was really quite traditional 1950s family. So couldn't, you know, Papa Bear stay with Mama Bear? You started to have some notion of changing the medication. How much medication did you actually need for early labor? If you were laboring just fine at home, how come you suddenly needed to be knocked out when you got there? So you had something moving towards what got called at various times prepared birth, natural birth. But basically, a lot of this came through a book by a woman called Marjorie Carmel, who had a baby, she's an American woman, had a baby in France with a Dr. Lamaz. And she wrote, "Thank you, Dr. Lamaz," and Lamaz got picked up, the Lamaz birth. Lamaz, if you go look at it, actually, is Russian Pavlovian conditioning. The guy went to Russia, saw that they taught people some techniques for dealing with labor, and it all got, quote, managed a lot easier with a lot less pain. In the 1950s, in the U.S., not a good moment for bringing in anything Russian, thank you, no, okay? Cold War moment. But run it through France and bring it in, post-World War II, woohoo, okay, we're in. So Lamaz, and like one of the things they taught was, and this makes sense, you know, if something hurts, you rub it gently. Like if you have a toothache, just watch. People with a toothache, they'll be rubbing their cheek. So Lamaz suggested you kind of rub your belly. And the word, you still can't find another word, but effleurage for rubbing your belly. He Frenchified it. And when I started looking at the food movement, I saw the same thing in the 1950s. You'd had these people who'd gone to Europe, seen France, see how people eat there, came back here, looked at their white bread and canned vegetables, and were like, I don't know about that. You had the La Pavillon, which is the pavilion from the World's Fair, doing a French restaurant, and suddenly doing things French became very popular in the U.S. And so I started looking at this sort of post-World War II comparison, and you thought, do the same thing. Don't really threaten industry at all. Go to the hospital, the doctor's in charge. The Lamaze technique teaching things were all, your doctor knows better than you what you need, but you can manage the birth nicer with effleurage and your husband whispering in your ear, puff, puff, pant, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And in food, it was, you can flambé your canned fruit cocktail. you know, they would start introducing little bits of Frenchifying, but still using canned fruit cocktail to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really intrigued me. But then in the 70s, when you started to have a real counterculture movement, it was, no, I don't want to buy the farm stuff. I want the real farm. I don't want this factory-made ugliness. And people in the birth world saying, this is not about being locked in a different room controlled by other people. I want to control this myself. And you started having this genuine alternative movement. Well, lo and behold, the both came pretty much out of California, sort of walking distance in San Francisco. You had the new food movement that, you know, Alice Waters represented, and the new birth movement that people saw in Ina Mae Gaskin.
Mm-hmm.
So out of the counterculture, you had, no, I'm not just going and using the industrial stuff and doing it a little prettier. I really want to take control, literally, from the man and move it back to the individual.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, many people might not know Ina Mae, but, you know, she...
Yeah, but that was part of what struck me, is that the alternative birth movement didn't take off in the same powerful way that the food movement did. And part of that is, just as I was saying before, you cook a lot. And it's really possible, and I think this is true of a lot of people, that they follow the food, quote, trends. They're thoughtful. They want to eat better. They want to use the organic this and the natural that, and shop at the farmer's market and do their CSA. And then, you know what? It's a Thursday evening. One of your kids has a science project due tomorrow. You've got a work thing that is overdue. And the hell with it, we're picking up Kentucky Fried Chicken on the way home.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do that. And tomorrow morning, we're back on track. In the birth world, you can say, well, let's see, we'll have most of our babies at home, but occasionally we'll have a cesarean. Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
Right.
So there requires a kind of a more of a long-standing commitment and deeper understanding of what's going on in the birth world. You can't do it like a fad. You have to really get into it. So the food movement, you have a lot of people who think they're in. They know the people. They know who, you know, Michael Pollan is, and they know who Alice Waters is. And, you know, they more or less sometimes, to some extent, keep up on that stuff and do some of it. Now you have people, when I had my home birth, we didn't have a word home birth. I had the baby at home. People had never heard, I hadn't heard of midwives. I didn't know anything about midwives in America. So people didn't know what midwifery was. They certainly didn't know that we have some midwives who are basically nurses who themselves have never seen a home birth, who work in hospitals as nurse midwives. It's a nurse practitioner version of midwives. And we have some midwives who are part of the midwifery movement and train out of hospital in a very different body of knowledge, who actually know how long things take when you're not flat on your back with your legs in the air, that kind of thing. So people didn't really know as much about the birth world. And that is something that I'm starting to see maybe changing a bit. People are becoming more knowledgeable. And it was certainly something I had in mind as I wrote this book, that, you know, here are these two worlds that are so parallel. I'd like you to understand some of that. Those mm-hmm. of you who think you know something about the food world, however, what will be the word I should use here, orthodox, your practices,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, don't know as much about the birth world. I wanted people to be able to see how similar these issues are.
Right. I can't help wondering if the reason the food movement has taken off so much quicker than the birth movement is because everybody eats, both men and women, and that
you know,
in the birth movement, you really have more of the women that are focused on this issue.
You know what? I don't think so, because actually, while you're saying the food movement is taken off and blah, 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 look at the percentage of processed corn in the American diet over the past 20 years. Have you done anything about that? No.
Yeah.
I mean, so, yes, more people talk the talk, but we haven't really made fundamental industrial change.
Right.
And on birth, absolutely. People do not just walk into their local hospital, choose the closest doctor, and, you know, whatever, I'm sure they all know what they're doing. People do think about birth, and they do read up and make choices and choose a practice that matches their values. Yes, it's all industrial. They're still in those hospitals, but we're still buying our food through industrial produce, too. So I'm not sure that it's been that much less successful. I think people do know a little bit about the birth world. And they didn't used to, and they do know a little bit about the food world, and they didn't used to. But we haven't made change in the big industrial forces in either movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, I think I mentioned at the beginning of today's show, you know, that I just had this film feast, food and film feast, this past weekend. And, you know, I'm constantly going through screening documentaries on food. And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, I'm sure there's more, but I really only know of one really good documentary on the birth movement, you know, the business of being born.
Yeah, there's dozens of them that are really good and
are
some
there?
Better than that one, but that's the one that took off, absolutely.
Right, right. Okay, so there are, okay, because I guess
yeah, there
I just
are,
haven't
but
really
it, no,
looked
it hasn't
for them.
Taken off the way the birth ones. And maybe, I don't actually think it's about women. I think it's about the power of medicalization in America. That one of the things that happened, you will hear grown people say, oh, I can't eat that, my doctor won't let me. The way you'll hear a child, like, I can't eat that, mommy won't let me,
mm-hmm.
it's about the same level of actual adherence,
mm-hmm.
you know, they do it anyway. But the notion that doctor knows best, that medicine, and now it's no longer so much your own doctor, let me go look up on, you know, WebMD or whatever, what medicine says.
Mm-hmm.
There is a power in the belief of medicine in America that is extraordinary. And the food movement isn't challenging that, and the birth movement is. And I think that's the difference. Not so much that it's women, because women are most of the obese now. I hear women saying, oh, I don't really need a midwife. I have a woman obstetrician and a doula.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that as
right.
she goes straight off into the hospital and into her cesarean. Because her women OB and her doulas have no birth skills. They're not trained for that. They're just trained to be nice to you, but your sister or your partner or your friend could do that. And kind of mystify what it is to take care of this somebody who's scared and hurt when we need a hired person to do it. And the woman OB has the same or higher cesarean section rates, unnecessary cesarean section rates, as the men OBs do. They have a little more probably because they have some of the work-life balance issues. They also have a kid they have to get home to and can't stay here all night for your labor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think the difference is women versus not women. That
mm-hmm.
I really think it's about the power of medicalization in America.
Yeah, I tell a story often of the client I was working with, where you know she had breast cancer, and I was cooking for her, and she was doing radiation. So I, in my studies, I know that you know miso is very helpful when someone has undergone radiation to counteract the radiation. And she goes, oh, I can't. My doctor won't let me have soy. And she comes home with like a dozen Dunkin' Donuts. Now, the doctor doesn't say don't have sugar, don't have artificial coloring, don't have preservatives, don't eat antibiotics and hormones, but he says don't eat soy. You know, and
not to mention
yeah,
which there's soy in so much of the ordinary food that you have to buy.
I know.
To go
you
look
know so
at
it. It's you know there is absurdity to this whole world, and you know, with the power of the internet, I mean, people really can take some of this control back and do some of their research. Your book is just wonderful because you've done so much of the research for everyone. It's really a great book, and I want to thank you so much for the work that you've done and the work that went into this.
Thank you.
It's really great. You're so welcome. Is there anything you'd like to share with my listeners before we have to go off the air? We're just about out of time.
No, go eat happy, eat hearty. I stuck some recipes in the book, too, that represented each of the eras. I wouldn't even necessarily recommend trying those recipes, but I did put a recipe in, and I laughed when I heard you give a recipe, that it's a way of connecting, and for each of the major eras of change, I put in a typical recipe of the era.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and one other story that I didn't share today, but when I got my first wok, you know, you talk about the canned vegetables, you know, flambéing fruit cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
I got a wok, and I opened a can of veg oil, and I was stir-frying canned vegetables
in my wok.
That was my background. That's what I knew about vegetables when I became
you've
a vegetarian.
Well, you've come a long way.
I have come a long way.
Yeah, I feel like
anyway,
I invented broccoli in my adulthood, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, you should get this book, A Bun in the Oven. You can, I know you can get it on Amazon. You probably can get it at most bookstores, Barbara, would you say?
Yeah, it's officially out in the next couple of days, so it should be available wherever you like to buy your books, and support your local bookstore if you can.
Great. And everyone, I want to thank you all for joining us. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll be with you again next week. Bye for now.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye, Barbara.